This season of the Peaches podcast is brought to you by our friends at Silverette. Now, many of you will know that this is a product that I have long sung the praises of. In fact, these little cups made up of antifungal, antimicrobial, healing, medical grade silver single-handedly saved my left nipple from early retirement when it came to breastfeeding. These are my go-to gift for any new mum. The Silverettes are simplistic genius. Little cups to protect and heal your nipples when you are in the trenches of learning how to breastfeed. Sore, oversensitive, cracked or even bleeding nips, no more. Guys, I have an exclusive discount for anyone wanting to give the new mum in their life the gift they will be thanking you for in years to come. 20% off using the code TORY20. Simply head to silverettaustralia.com. Now, this expires on the 30th of June, 2023, so you don't want to muck about. The link is in our show notes. Hello and welcome back to the Peaches podcast. Guys, today I am welcoming Betsy Westcott. She is a financial coach, personal finance commentator, and an executive who believes that everyone, but particularly women, deserve to live a financially free and secure life. She does also happen to be one of my besties. In fact, Betsy's husband, Brett, is our daughter Isabella's godfather. And Chris, my husband, is their son's Bruce's godfather. So it's all very cute. Today is going to be a real mix of leaning into Betsy's incredible professional knowledge, but also a chance for us to openly discuss some personal matters around motherhood, fertility, grief, and more. So strap in, Peaches, because it's D&M time. Boo, welcome. Welcome to the potty.
Gal, I'm so happy to be here. Obviously this feels very professional because we've got headphones on, but I honestly feel like we're just catching up.
You're at my house a lot.
Yeah.
Good today to be back. You wore a shirt. I'm like, oh, you look so nice.
I did my hair for you. Not that anyone can see it, but you're welcome.
We'll take a photo after. Sure. We'll make sure it's noted. Babe, do you want to start by giving us a brief recap of your professional trajectory the last 10 years? Because mama has done a lot.
Oh, thank you. Isn't it funny how like 10 years when you're younger feels like a lifetime and now you're like, is it only 10? Crazy. Did not intend to be in finance. Like who grows up wanting to be a banker? Not me. actually started in like hotel resort management because I love languages and travel and thought that would be my career, but fell into banking and actually discovered I loved it. I think I tried to talk you into banking. I don't know if that's a side
you
note.
Did. It wasn't successful. I thought I was going to be like Betsy and just kill it. That's the story for another day. Yeah. If anyone who knows me knows that it just wasn't quite right.
It was fun exploration. But yeah, this is why it's so important to know what you value and enjoy doing. So anyway, back to that, fell into retail banking. So in the branches and was like a teller, home lender, eventually became a bank manager at the very ripe old age of about 22, which was very funny trying to convince the residents of Mossman that the 22-year-old was the bank manager. And then from there, I discovered the world of private banking where you're looking after very wealthy families and individuals. And I loved that. That was like the Disneyland of banking. And one of my clients from that was like, hey, I'm going to start a new bank. Do you want to come and help me? And I was like, who starts a new bank? And yeah, I'm in. So that's when I pivoted into the world of fintech and kind of really building, using technology to create inclusive and more ethical financial products and services, because that really aligns with what I care about. So worked at Zinger Bank, did a little stint at Macquarie Bank, and then went back to fintech as the chief revenue officer at FutureU. But whilst doing all that fintech stuff, I really miss the one-on-one of interacting with clients and giving them advice. So in that time, helped launch the Ladies Finance Club, as well as my own coaching practice. And then today I continue doing the coaching practice full-time as a financial wellness coach.
Yes, you've recently made a step to being self-employed, which we will discuss in detail later. But a big fuck yes to that. Okay, so thank you for that. I feel like it's a ridiculously impressive trajectory that you've been on. But today we are here to talk mainly about money and how bettering our relationship with that enables us to live the lives that we truly desire. You are always banging on about how it shouldn't be a dirty word, and women particularly should not shy away from this subject. I feel like in 2023, we are still seeing women leaving the business of personal finances to their male counterparts in relationships. And of course, this can exacerbate domestic issues like coercive control or emotionally or physically violent relationships, because I guess at the end of the day, if we have nothing to fall back on, leaving an abusive situation would be made all the more impossible. So this is fucking important stuff. Mm. I would love to start by discussing why achieving financial well-being is so much more complicated and challenging for women.
Yeah. So let's define financial well-being, because, like, what does it mean? Do you need to be a Kardashian to be financially well, or what are we talking about? So financial well-being is defined as being able to say yes to three things. One, do you have enough money to meet your day-to-day needs? Two, do you have savings that are set aside to kind of get you out of a sticky situation, deal with a bit of a financial crisis? And then number three, are you putting money away for your long-term goals, those lifestyle ambitions? So if you can say yes to all those three things, then congratulations, you have financial well-being. If you can say yes to some of them, that's awesome. And then, you know, let's talk about how we can work on that. But for women in particular, achieving financial well-being is more complicated because our lives are actually quite complex. First of all, there's that really pesky, persistent gender pay gap, which has actually gone down recently. So hurrah. It's still at 13.3%, according to the last Workplace Gender Equality Australia survey. Then our careers tend to be more disrupted because men can't have babies, physically at least. So, you know, we take time out of the workforce for not only raising families and caring for children, but women are also societally more often expected to do the elder caregiving. 71% of the elder caregiving that happens here in Australia through families is performed by women. So you can just see there's that societal expectation that we will prioritize family over career and finance. Mm. And then because of all these disruptions, we're not earning money as consistently. We're more likely to work part-time, meaning that we have less wealth at the end of the day. And when we retire, on average, we have about 35% less money, or two-thirds of the money that men retire with. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but because we live longer, on average, we live 5 years longer, and also our health is a lot more complicated. We have sort of more complex medical needs. That means we've got less money to service a more complicated life for longer. And that's why we're seeing in Australia that one of the fastest growing cohorts experiencing homelessness is single women over the age of 55. And I don't want that to be anyone I know and care about. So if I can help people understand money, make the most out of their money, and live that sort of financially free, secure, purposeful life, I'm like, that's a life well lived.
Well, that's what I was about to say, right? All of these things are all well and good for women to, in quotation marks, sacrifice for, right? Raising children, looking after grandparents and parents and sick family members. That's all well and good if you stay with your partner and they look after you. But let's face it, divorce rates are, what are they now?
I think it's one in three marriages in Australia ends in separation. And that's just saying marriages. So we're not accounting for long-term partnerships there either. So, yeah.
So that's kind of like... You know, it's all well and good if you've got your partner who has worked throughout that period of time and you're going to have shared wealth. But it, as it sounds like,
one time out of every three, it ain't happening.
Yeah, and it actually, there's a lot of research that shows that it takes women longer to recover from a financial separation, from a relationship breakdown. So I may be misquoting because I'm remembering this off the top of my head, but I believe it's about 2 years for a man to recover to be in the financial position he was in before the separation, and a woman it's about 5 to 6 years.
Mm.
So, and, you know, that's because of
all the things we just mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's that classic saying, a man is not a financial plan. And I want to make it really clear, I am, you know, not anti-men or think that you shouldn't, like, I don't have any views that you shouldn't join finances with your partner or anything like that. What I am a big advocate for is that you participate in your own financial well-being. You know, you are the sort of captain of your own financial well-being. And because no one's going to care about your money like you care about your money. And the moment that you abdicate from being financially responsible for yourself, that's the moment that you hand over control of your own life.
Yes. Oh, that was a bit of a mic drop moment.
Oh, thanks.
For you. Okay, so we have kind of briefly touched on it, but I want to talk a little bit more about whether you think we're seeing a hangover from the social norms of yesteryear, where women traditionally took a back seat when it came to the business side of running a household, with many of them simply trusting what their partners chose to tell them about the financial state of their families and working with whatever money was made available to them for things like raising children and providing meals. So I'm talking about like women traditionally staying home, not working, not being across money at all. Mm-hmm. And obviously now we see much less of that. There's a far more balance in households. Women are working, you know, far more. Some women are actually the breadwinners in their relationship. But I still feel like those old kind of concepts around letting men run the finances have kind of clung on. What do you think?
Yeah, it takes a long time to create societal change. So if you think historically around women and money, the world of finance absolutely excluded women. Like our grandmas, and it, you know, it was probably quite close to even our mother's era. You know, a lot of women, they couldn't open a bank account in their own name. They couldn't own property in their own name or even inherit property for some of them. When you got married, and certainly if you fell pregnant, you had to quit your job. You couldn't continue to earn money. So women were incredibly disempowered when it came to access and to control of wealth and money. And then traditional financial services very often undercater the female market and the female audience. You know, you take superannuation, for example, this vehicle that we all have and we're all investing into to create wealth in retirement. When they created that product, they designed it on the basis of a middle management male working a 40-year uninterrupted career. Many people don't have an uninterrupted career today, especially women. And so a lot of the expected outcomes and results that we are planning for super to deliver to us aren't accounting for the gender pay gap, interrupted careers, you know, part-time work and so forth. And that's why women don't achieve the same outcomes. So there's that element, and then there's that societal element where, you know, social norms around it's rude to talk about money. It's unfeminine to talk about money. Don't you bother your pretty little head with that. You know, yeah. It's a bit too complicated. You know, just worry about spending less and saving more. We don't talk to women about how do they create wealth. The good news is that is absolutely shifting. Women are controlling more wealth than ever before in terms of superannuation, in terms of households. Women are the chief decision maker when it comes to household expenditure. So that's good. Like we're kind of controlling the purse strings about what's going out the door. But again, it's what we want to encourage is seeing more women leaning into the wealth creation side and those big kind of decisions for families. But yeah, I think it was about 30% of boomer women are financially engaged and make decisions in their own household, whereas for millennial and Gen Z, it's up to close to the 60% mark. So we are actually really making some progress. It's awesome to see what young female Australians are doing. They're really taking, still just stepping into the driver's seat of their own financial lives, which I'm like, fuck yeah. But there's still more work to be done.
Obviously. Always more work to be done. And I think that's why it's important that we have this discussion, because I do think that we live in a little bit of a bubble, right? Like, I would say, you know, half of my friends are in breadwinning roles in their relationships. My female friends, I have friends whose husbands have taken parental leave, and all of that stuff is really cool. And we are definitely kind of, you know, you're still seeing it happen and going, oh, that's quite good. That's quite forward of us, isn't it?
It's so modern.
Yeah. Look at us just fucking killing it. But at the end of the day, I think that we're in a really small sort of top tier, and actually the bulk of our communities are still kind of set back. So it's really important for us to make sure we consider these things, and for the well-being of all women and people, and for our future generations, like, leaning into this stuff is massive.
Yeah. Well, on that point about earning more, like, societally we still haven't kind of adjusted to that redefining of gender roles, you know, because a lot of the ways that we define what is a good, successful man is his ability to provide and ability to earn more money. And, you know, when a woman earns more, her vulnerability to experiencing domestic violence increases by 35%. So
30, like, let's just take a second. Can you repeat that, please?
Yeah. So when a woman earns more than her partner, her vulnerability to experiencing domestic violence goes up by 35%, because societally we haven't really recalibrated to women stepping in to society more and earning more, and just kind of rethinking how do we define our value as individuals, as genders, and beyond. And there's work to be done there.
And that work is emotional and educational.
And that's why I do couples coaching, because I have, through my career, what I see is one of the biggest challenge and one of the number one topics that couples fight about, and the biggest driver for separation in the early years of marriage, is fights about money, because we grow up in these very different experiences, and then we're also growing up in a time where there's a big societal shift around, you know, women's roles, men's roles, how we parent, how we work. And we don't really have a blueprint for it. And then we get married, and again, you know, we're not often taught or role modeled how to have conversations around, you know, what does it even mean to be a husband and wife, and what do we expect of each other, let alone, you know, what kind of roles do we want to play in terms of making money, managing money, raising families? What are our priorities? How are we going to, you know, manage money on a day to day? And there's a lot of assumptions, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of emotion, and resulting in couples really struggling to navigate this area of their life and navigate it well. And the end result is that often it ends in relationship breakdown, which is tragic.
Amen, girl. I mean, this leads me to my next question. Love, money, and financial abuse. Money is hard to discuss at the best of times, but it can be especially fraught and emotionally charged in relationships. You've just mentioned the statistics around domestic violence rates going up when women earn more. Do you know anything about how much more difficult it is for women to leave a family home if they are entirely financially dependent on their partner?
It's nearly impossible, because you can't escape when you have no means to support yourself. You have no means to create a new home, to create a new safe environment. So, you know, and it's a lot of women, when we talk about emergency savings, right, or there's a lot of names for it. But so often my clients, depending on what experiences they've had growing up and also what their mothers have talked to them about. So many of my clients have the pack up and shoot through fund, which is another word for emergency fund. But I think it's their mothers have grown up in an era and sort of drilled into them the importance of having access to money in order to have control, in order to have independence. And you know what? I think it's not a bad thing for women to have some access to their own money, for that very reason. And it's not just about leaving a bad relationship, but, you know, if your partner controls the bulk of the money and the accounts are all in their name and then they pass away. Those accounts get frozen by the bank if they're not a joint account. Mm. So then you just don't have access to money for that reason. Or if they get sick and they haven't passed away, but you don't know what the logins are and have, you know, cards to access the account to pay the bills, then that's a problem because they're still there, but they're not able to make the decisions they once had. So I'm getting tangled in the microphone, gesticulating too wildly. But yeah, it is nearly impossible when you don't have access to your own money, your own income, for you to be empowered to make choices for yourself and for your well-being.
And like you said, even taking it back from like an emergency fund and an abusive relationship, actually just having a little talk to yourself about practical skills. Here's a really good example with Chris and I. Mm. Chris does payroll for our entire team and like the team is growing. We have a lot of employees and payroll has changed a lot since old Tory Clapham was in charge of it. and we have some really nice processes now that I am not across, because that is his role within our business. Mm. But in the last few weeks, Chris and I have said to each other, like, I really need to be across how to do it, because if, God forbid, Chris injured himself, was in a car crash and in the hospital, like, we have over 50 young women who rely on us for their paycheck to pay their rent and buy their food, and someone needs to be able to step in and do it then and there. And I was thinking to myself today, like, oh, my God, I'm like living this reality that I want to talk to Betsy about, where it's like, oh, my husband handles that, but I really need to learn how to do it. So all good things for us to be discussing. Going back to talking about domestic violence and abusive relationships, because I do think that that subject is such a big part of what we want to cover today. I think it's important for us to know the difference between financial abuse and coercive control, because there's a lot of kind of talk in that space, isn't there? Can you shed some light?
Yeah. So financial abuse, about 1 in 30 women, 1 in 60 men will ever experience financial abuse. But by definition, it's someone takes away your access to money, manipulates your financial decisions, or uses money without your consent. It's alarmingly prevalent, but it's quite a, like, the more extreme end. The stuff that kind of can happen and is a little bit like under the radar is that coercive control. So coercive control, there's like 12 different forms. Financial coercive control is just one of them. And it's where someone like limits your access to money and starts controlling your finances. And it's a way that they sort of start restricting your freedom, restricting your sort of sense of agency, and ultimately restricting your ability to leave a relationship through financial means. So examples might be like they place you on a really strict budget where you can only have access to just enough money to cover the bare essentials, and then anytime you need extra money because, I don't know, someone's got sick or you need to replace your shoes or, you know, buy new underwear for yourself, you have to go to them and ask, right? That's one of the examples. Or they will only let you have access to a couple of the bank accounts, but all the investments and the super and, you know, the mortgage account, they take care of that and you can't see that. Because the thing about financial well-being, it particularly in a relationship, it doesn't mean you have to control every decision. Mm. You just need to be across every decision. You need to be an equal participant in terms of access to information, access to accounts, and an understanding of what's going on there. So you don't have to become the family CFO if that is not your jam.
Yes, I love that, Beds. I think because, you know, I'm included in this group of people. Like, I actually think that it is better for Chris to do to the day-to-day management of things because he is wired that way. Mm. And there are things that I excel and he excels at. But what's important, you know, which I am very much involved in, is me being across the decision. So I think that's such an important takeaway from this conversation. You don't have to be running the ship. You just need to be on the ship and having a conversation with the bloody captain.
about like what direction are you going, and if there's like something really big that you're partaking in those decisions, and you know where things are because, it's, you want to be a team. You want to be a team. That's basically the message I want you to take away.
Be a team. And when we talk a little bit more about financial abuse, like would examples like a partner making a big decision without you, such as purchasing a car or even something is that seems really benign, but this has always made me kind of wonder, like booking a really extravagant holiday, but it's like, oh, it's for you as a surprise. Like, is that actually, I don't know, is that actually okay? I guess it depends on the context.
So like if it's an extravagant holiday that goes against or disrupts that goal that you guys set of buying a house and like you're like, but we could be using this money to do this thing that we talked about. And again, you weren't a part of it. Like that could be an example.
I just think it's really interesting, right? Like, oh, it's a grand romantic gesture, but like, and it's funny, like I will say things to Chris, like, oh, I like surprises, like freaking surprise me. But there's no way I would want him doing something as big as that. And he never would, because he would never make a big financial decision without discussing it with me first.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to shine the spotlight on these smaller, in quotation marks,
red flags.
Red flags, exactly.
Yeah. So that's what I see a lot of in my day-to-day. Well, I shouldn't say I see a lot, but I see from time to time, because I do a lot of work with individuals and with couples. So, you know, little red flags. Here's a story I heard the other day, and it was like, you know, a mate of a mate won a whole heap of money at the pokies, right? And the story was something like he won 30 grand. And he took all of his mates on a ski trip to New Zealand, and he's like, you just can't, and he paid for everyone. And he said to the boys, and this is like not anyone close to me, so everyone's like, who's she talking about? But a friend of a friend, and he just said, look, guys, I'm going to take us on this ski trip. We're going to go to New Zealand. We're going to have the best time. I've booked it all. You just can't tell my wife that I'm paying for it. I told her we had a win on the pokies, and that's paying for me to go on the trip. And I've given her, you know, like $5,000 and told her that was half, you know, red fucking flag, you know. But there's smaller things like people might do things like just even like overstate or, you know, create a misconception about how much wealth they have, or they might hide wealth, or they might hide debt. They might have used things like shopping to self-soothe and not actually deal with the emotion that they're feeling. You know, they had a bad day at work. Well, they just click on the Iconic and order two new pairs of shoes. And like that's unhealthy money behavior. And it's not even about the money. It's just the fact that you actually haven't developed the life skills to deal with whatever's actually going on. So those can be like little red flags, or getting really emotional so that, you know, whenever you ask about money or try to have a conversation, they're so reactive. Yeah, and you're shut down each time. So they're just some examples of like the different kind of red flags that we see.
I think this is a really nice interlude into how relationships with money are so much more complicated. Mm-hmm. And you've touched on it a little bit, like emotional attachment to money, the way that you see your financial success, like it's so much more about, of course, we can talk about privilege and background, but I know that you do a lot of deep diving with your clients into their what do you call it? You call it like their personal...
Their money psychology the archetypes that are at play. So I think so much of our financial success is not determined by how much we earn or how smart we are or the investments we make. So much of it is determined by our own relationship with money. And what's really interesting is a lot of the thoughts and the behaviors and the patterns we have around money are things that were established at a very early age. So research out of Cambridge University has revealed that the majority of our money beliefs, patterns, and behaviors are formed by the age of 7. Like 7 years old, 7 year old Betsy did not know what was up. she certainly didn't understand like income and taxes and wealth.
You're absorbing your mother and your father and the conversations and what was made available to you, what was a treat, what was expected, whether you had pocket money, all that shit.
Absolutely. And so those, like, whether money was scarce, whether money was something people fought about, how we spoke about people who did or didn't have money, a lot of these attitudes are formed at a really, really young age and through the mind and eyes of a child, which is why so often we have like these conflicted feelings about money where you're like, I don't know why, like sometimes I'm all or nothing, you know. And so understanding and bringing that to our sort of conscious mind, because again, they're things that were formed very early. They sit in our subconscious mind and our emotional brain, and they just run on autopilot. And it's only when we sort of bring them out into the light and understand them, do we have the opportunity to reframe them in a way where they can work for us and not against us. So a lot of what I do with clients is actually spending time understanding what are their natural patterns, what are their belief systems that are running, and how do they sort of respond and react to money so that we can create a really strong foundation for them to build wealth from. Because and this is why financial advice doesn't work for a lot of people. 80% of the financial plans that very thoughtfully and lovingly put together by financial advisors aren't followed. And the reason being is they focus on the strategy too much and not enough on the psychology that we need to understand and account for to create a sustainable plan that someone can actually adhere to. So that's why I spend a lot of time with my clients around understanding that money, psychology, behavior patterns.
Oh my God, it just makes so much sense. I'm also just kind of sitting here a little bit in awe.
Oh.
You're so good. I always say to Betsy, guys, I'm like, you need to be on the morning show every week being the financial commentator. And I mean, you guys can see why. If anyone out there is a producer for Channel 7 or Channel 9, can you please call this bitch up? Jesus. All right, what's my next question? I'm flustered. I don't even know where I'm going.
I've got like a hype girl crush.
I'll always be your hype girl. Okay, speaking of buzz things that we can talk about, which you spoke recently about on the morning show, I believe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Gender wealth gap, why it matters. I feel like we always hear about the pay gap, but from my understanding, that's only part of the problem.
Well, it contributes to the problem, and it probably distracts us from what it leads to. So
like, let's feel angry about this. Is that what you mean?
Not so much angry, but more just aware of, you know, the compound effect of a pay gap. So we talk about the pay gap, it's 13.3%. Now I can't remember the exact stats, but you know, in and of itself, it's a couple of $100 a week or a month that, you know, women on average are earning less than men. So you're like, oh, that doesn't sound great, but like, what does it matter? But for International Women's Day, I put together a scenario where I had a husband and a wife. He was earning the median wage for men. She was earning the median wage for women. He worked for 40 years uninterrupted. She, however, took some time out, about 8 years out, to raise two kids. Then in her 50s, she took a couple of years out to look after an elderly parent. And then she got to her mid-60s and ended up retiring a couple of years earlier because hubby was like, babe, I'm retired. Come on, let's get the caravan. Let's go traveling. She's like, okay. And what that sort of interrupted earning capacity, that gender pay gap, resulted in was $1.7 million of difference in money earned throughout their lifetime. So, you know, without that capital, she doesn't create the same amount of wealth he did. And obviously, like, as a couple, they've probably pooled resources and so forth. But what I'm trying to highlight is just the nature and trajectory of women's life have a real financial cost. Now, I'm not saying don't raise families. I'm not saying don't look after your parents. I'm not saying don't pursue meaningful work, even if it's in a lower paid industry. Go in with your eyes wide open and then put in steps that can actively counter that. So, for example, I was very privileged to know, working in financial services, that at some point I would want to have kids, and that would mean I took some time out of the workforce, which would mean I wouldn't be contributing to my retirement savings. Now, on average, that'll mean that a woman doesn't contribute about $13,000 to retirement savings during, say, a two-year period to go and have kids. What that equates to by the time they retire is about $125,000 less in income. So anyway, that's the average stats. But I knew that that was going to happen for me. So I made additional contributions to my super while I was in my 20s, which means that I've already kind of prepaid my mat leave and I've already kind of made up that money in my super.
While you had a more disposable income.
Yeah, exactly. So, and this is, again, the why the practice of financial well-being is so fun and exciting, is that it gives you more choice and more freedom in life. So when you take care of your money takes care of you. So, you know, if you make sure that you've always got some emergency savings, say the equivalent of 3 to 6 years worth of living expenses set aside in a savings account, it means that if someone gets sick, you can, you know, go home and look after them. Or if you're in a toxic share house situation and you just need to bolt and find somewhere better to live, you've got money to do that. Or if you're at a workplace and you've got a creepy boss and you're like, I am, you know, and you've been gaslit and you've been overworked and you're like, I just need to take a break before I go find a new job, you've got money there to do with it. If you start, you know, contributing to your super early, it means that the, the career break you'll have around maternity leave doesn't impact you. You'll have wealth to live off in retirement. You can go cruising the med with your bestie if you want to. It's just, it gives you so much freedom and choice.
Mm.
And it's so easy. And the more you do that when you're younger, the less you have to do.
I think this is the thing, right? Mm. It's not anything major, but you have to pull your finger out and have a look at it and have a discussion and make a plan. I think for so many people, and I'm definitely included in this, you're kind of like, oh, that's a later me problem. But if you can just take some simple steps earlier, I mean, we all know about the compounding effects of wealth, right? Mm. Like if you start putting money away sooner, it will pay back in dividends.
Yeah, and I think it's like money needs a rebrand. Like, I love spending money, right? You too. I mean, girlfriend, I know you do. We all have a good time. You're like, what, lunch with spritz? Yes, I'm in. Let me at it, Maryvale.
fucking Maryvale. They get me every time.
I feel like I give so much of my money to him. But like,
they get it so right and they deserve it. I'm like, you know what? You did a good job.
You did a good job, honey.
Pay $200 for this lunch. You nailed it again.
But if we can reframe like financial well-being to be a self-care practice and like, whenever I'm sitting down with my money, I'm making it a pleasurable experience. I've got a glass of wine. I've got some beads on. Man, light a candle, if you will. I don't care. But make it fun. Don't make it like a chore. Don't make it like personal punishment. You know, the word budget brings up feelings of – exactly. It brings up that. Whereas reframe it to my spending plan, where it's like I choose
that's
to make
– that's fun.
Exactly.
What am I going to spend money on?
Exactly right. And you're like, I'm really good at this. Whereas like you're like, I'm really bad at budgeting, but spending, well, actually. And it's the exact same thing, but it's just you're making a plan for your money to go where you want it to go. Because, again, if you don't have a plan for your money, like I'm just looking over at Tori's iPhone, I'm like, you probably pick up that thing 72 times a day, maybe more. And every time you pick it up, there's an ad or there's an image or there's something influencing you to spend money on stuff that you don't need. But when you don't have like a good clear view of what are my values, what are my priorities, then those ads are going to work on you every time and get you spending money on shit that doesn't make you happy. And like, put your money into things that make you happy. Put your money into safety and security. Put your money into beautiful experiences. Put your money into, you know, creating that home and that life that you so desire. And to do that, you just need to have a plan for your money.
I love it. I love it. And I really appreciate the way that you're trying to reframe this whole budgeting kind of vibe into like self-care.
Yeah.
So what are like your top three steps for or top three tips for making your financial well-being a part of your self-care routine?
Okay. So first of all, think about what life you want to live. I think first and foremost, like, what do you want a life to look like? How do you want it to feel? Where do you want to live? Where do you want to work? Who do you want to spend your time with?
Is travel important to you?
Absolutely, yes. So, you know, and really get clear. And essentially this is goal setting, right? But being really clear, like what I want to have happen in the next 1 to 3 years, you know, 4 to 6, 7 plus. Then from there, it's around creating a system that's going to support you achieving those goals. So whether that's how you spend your money on the day-to-day, how you put savings aside to either create security or build up towards those goals, Yeah, and making sure that that system is like automated, easy to do. Mm. And then number three, and this one's really important for ladies, and I just want to like let you all know, statistically, women are better investors than men. We actually achieve better financial outcomes when we invest, but we've got this kind of view that it's like really hard and you need to be the Wolf of Wall Street in order to invest. Bullshit.
I do feel that. I do feel completely overwhelmed at the idea of investing, and I'm like, it's risky. I just want my money in the bank where I can see it.
Yeah.
I need your help.
Yeah. And you know what? That really serves the financial services industry for you to think that, because then you'll go and be like, help me, take my money, do it for me. But the thing is, if you got through grade 8 math and, you know, basic English, you have all the smarts within you to become a really successful investor. And investing is not complicated. It's, you know, you just need to understand the foundational concepts and align it to a goal, and then it becomes paint by numbers. And like, it's... And like, yeah, I can't go into all like the information, but we should so do a session.
No, well, they should be coming to you as clients yeah. or enrolling in your e-courses. But I love those top three tips. Yeah, okay.
Learn how to invest.
So another thing that you talk about a lot when it comes to achieving financial stability is by getting your ducks in a row by assembling a financial A-team. Mm. This is like your kind of lingo.
Yeah.
Who is this A-team? Why do we need them in our lives?
Yeah.
Fill me in.
Well, you know how like Beyonce just doesn't happen by herself? Like she's got like a whole...
Girlfriend has an assistant and a hairdresser yeah. and makeup and wardrobe. Okay, I'm on board. Yeah. Yep.
It's like that equivalent, but for your financial life, right? So obviously you want to, you know, engage in your money, make it really fun, get really excited about building this exciting life for yourself, but you're going to need some experts to help you out along the way. So it could be in the form of a financial coach who's going to help you understand your values, help you get really clear on your goals, build that knowledge.
BessieWestcott.com.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, missed that.
You know, if you're going,
or anyone.
Or anyone. You know, if you're running a business or if you're just trying to maximize the most of your income each year, it could be an accountant. It could be a financial advisor who's going to teach you how to create wealth and help you, give you like a strategy to building that life. When you're looking to buy a house, you might use a buyer's agent like you guys did, like I did, as well as, you know, talk to a mortgage broker to help you find the best loan. It'll be someone like an insurance broker to help you set up all your personal insurances so that if anything bad happens, like you lose your job, you get injured, you get sick, you're not financially ruined by that event. You've got resilience. You might use a lawyer for your estate planning to help you ensure that, you know, when you pop off from this earth, your money goes where you want it to, your family's taken care of. So yeah, these are all the players that might be in your A team. Depending where you are in life will depend who you need to engage, but think of it as like assembling the Beyonce support team.
And that these are the people who you should be delegating to. Like, I guess the message is you don't have to do it alone, delegate. And yes, it's an investment, but it pays back tenfold, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It can save you from some expensive financial mistakes.
I love it. I love it. Okay. Now, girlfriend, I knew this would happen. We're already 40 minutes in. I want to sidestep now.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the real Betsy Westcott, because as you guys can hear, she's extremely impressive. She's very eloquent. She's got it all down packed. But I think it's really nice when we kind of open the kimono and we show the woman or the person behind the profile. Can we start with like talking about how your approach to work changed since you became a mummy?
Yeah, it was something I was not expecting. I always like, you've known me for a long time, Tours, like I've always been that career corporate gal. I very much was like, I'm always going to work. I'm always going to want to be in like some high powered executive role. It's going to be about how much money I can earn. And like,
and actually even like children wasn't, yes, you're definitely doing it. It was a discussion that you had with your husband. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of girls our age, women our age, however you want to refer to them, they go into relationships and it is 100% expected. It is not a conversation. Do we want children? Is this something that I am willing to undergo? Because let's be honest, it's a fucking sacrifice. Yeah. And so I really respected that. Like I thought, oh God, that's really cool that like Betsy and Brett are actually having a conversation around not when, but if
Yeah, it was a part of a broader thing. I think I grew up in a home where my parents were separated and there was a lot of animosity. And, you know, one of the catalysts to us having a lot of these conversations was when he proposed, because even though, like, on my, like, conscious, logical brain, I was like, that's what I want. I want to get married to Brett. I want to, you know, commit to him. My subconscious brain was
the lizard,
like,
is that right? Is that what they call it? The lizard
brain?
Yeah,
it could have been, but it was basically like, run! Because I'd grown up learning that, like, marriage led to unhappiness. And so, you know, I had to do some work on myself to really talk myself through the fact that, like, my journey wasn't my parents' journey, that, you know, marriage is what you made it. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking around what were our expectations of each other to be husband, to be wife. And I think I spent a lot of my 20s kind of thinking about, if I was going to get married, what did I want that marriage to look like? And then being really communicative with Brett around what I wanted and expected, and then curious around what he wanted and expected, and then making a kind of decision to then co-create that together. And for me, my priority was to have a happy, healthy marriage before I brought a child into that, because I just didn't want to sort of subject a child to anything less than that.
Babe, I find it so refreshing, and I think it's so, like, fucking woke of you guys to have done that. Because you see it time and time again. People dive into relationships, they spit out kids, and the marriage is an afterthought. And actually it should be the starting point, and it should always be the priority first.
Mm.
So we kind of took a little
I didn't go back to a career. Yeah. So, there was a couple of things at play. One, I always thought I would be like corporate executive Betsy running companies, and I still aspire to do all of that. But
you've actually sort of done that as well.
Little bit. Yeah, and I also was very conscious of, like, trying to set myself up as to be in the best position I could by the time I went to have kids. So was very much like making sure I could get as senior as I possibly could and earn as much money as I possibly could. And then my logic was, cool, I'll be able to pay for the support that I need, and I'll have a lot more choice. I'll be super employable. And then the thing I didn't account for is that executive roles are really not that flexible. Like, unless you're in one of those unicorn companies, which increasingly there's more of, but there's not heaps. We've got good representation of women in executive roles, but there's still a long way to go. So I got to, like, chief revenue officer in the C-suite. But what I realized through working in that role was that it's not a 5-day-a-week job. It's a 24/7 job.
Mm.
And it's a 24/7 job where you're working for someone else. So you are beholden to someone else. And I think I was lucky that, you know, parallel to kind of making it up the corporate ladder and getting those kind of roles, I'd also started to realize, like, you know, I wanted to have a little bit more self-expression in my work. And that's so I started my coaching business as a way to kind of scratch the itch of wanting to have that one-on-one contact and helping people. But what I inadvertently created was a career cushion.
Handy.
Yeah, very handy. Because once I had my son, and through conversations Brett and I had had around, like, what did our perfect life look like and what did we really want? And a lot of the things were, you know, control over our time and the kind of parents we wanted to be and the kind of work that we wanted to do. And so it's kind of taken me on a bit of a pivot to, I want to do meaningful work, and I hope eventually I'll make the money I used to make. But, you know, that means earning less than I once did. But I also want to have flexibility and control over what I do. And so creating my own business has meant that I get to set my hours and I get to write my, you know, my leave form. And that means I can kind of be the parent that I want to be. And it's really important for me to have work Betsy, because that's my identity. It's like a really important part of my identity. But the kind of parent I want to be, particularly whilst our first son, Bruce, is young, I want to be available to him. I want to be raising him. I want to be role modeling to him. And so, yeah, that's kind of why I've pursued this pivot of moving into self-employment for a number of reasons, but one of the biggest ones is it aligns with the lifestyle and the kind of parent I want to be.
And the control. I think what you said, you know, from all of that, which all of it hit home and resonated, but one, you know, a few words really stuck with me was control of your time. I think that is huge. And I think that any parent to a young child understands how important that is, because shit comes up all the time. And when your child is sick, having the control of your time and the control of your work to just drop everything and know that you can see to it at a later date is priceless.
Yeah.
And like, I don't think I've always been great at forward planning. In fact, I would not say that it is the biggest skill of mine. However, when it comes to family planning and work-life balance, it was something that I thought about at a very young age. I knew that I wanted to be a mother, and I knew that I didn't want crazy work expectations put on me. Like, actually having grown up with parents who both had like had really demanding jobs. I mean, my mum was like incredible and available to us, but also my parents worked like 6-7 days a week. My dad was a surgeon who was on call, like missed things a lot because sick people cannot wait. They cannot wait. And so, excuse me, when I went about the business of setting up Peaches, quite uncharacteristically, at, you know, the ripe old age of whatever it was, early 20s. Like,
yeah, 25.
One of my biggest like think points was I want to have a family one day and I want to set this up now because I know it's going to take a fucking long time.
Yeah.
So that by the time I get around to raising my family, I have that control. Mm. And having that control now is such a privilege in our day-to-day lives. Look, I'm still working on exercising that control and my own boundaries and like my processing around guilt and commitments and being able to actually outsource, you know, emotionally. However, it is available to me, and that's a starting point.
Yeah, no, you were onto it so early because I remember you talking to me about that and, you know, a bit
while we were getting fucked up at the bar. Probably. I don't know why. It was on my mind.
God, we had a good time. Honestly, to all of those in your 20s right now, like, have the best time.
Have the best time. Don't be too healthy. At least young, really, 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 really clean eating 20 something year olds. Make sure you just have some fun. Nights out, please.
Yeah,
please have a couple of regrets.
Yeah. Oh my God, Tori, don't we have a few of those?
Oh my God, we sure.
Anyway,
do.
Not for the podcast.
Maybe another episode.
Yeah.
But while we're talking about the real Betsy Westcott and, you know, your own personal experiences, I do want to touch on two more subjects.
Hmm.
One is that you have long been knee-deep in a heavily male-dominated work environment. And even though we wish it wasn't so, it has naturally meant that you've had to navigate the goddamn fucking bullshit that comes with that territory, let's be frank. Things like sexual harassment, gaslighting, they're still so common in this world, and it's actually something that I'm really disconnected from in my world of Peaches because our company employs, you know, however many women, 50, 60, 70 women, and then there's one man. So the women won't run the show.
He's probably getting harassed.
In the world of Peaches.
I'll ask
if
him.
Anyone's getting harassed, it's Chris. And I know we shouldn't make light of that, but that's our reality. And, you know, but I mustn't forget that my sisters are out there still, you know, dealing with this shit on a day-to-day basis. Can you share some of your experience of having worked in such a male-dominated industry?
Oh, my God, like all the things. I think like what happened in my experience. So, yeah, I've...
And also, sorry, just to kind of preface this, it's probably important to note also that, like, not only is Betsy very successful and in a male-dominated industry and very eloquent, but, like, and sometimes to your disadvantage, you're an incredibly striking woman. You're incredibly beautiful. So people like to assume things about you before you get a chance to open your mouth.
Yeah, I don't know how to respond to that except to say thank you. I'm like blushing red here. Like I said, hype girl. honestly, like I think, and it's so many women listening to this will have experienced it, from people like not believing that you're in the position you're in. Like, I was very young when I became a bank manager, but I literally would have customers come in and be like, hello, I would like to speak to the bank manager. And I'd be like, hi, yeah, that's me. And they're like, oh, hello, yes, thank you, dear. No, I'm just waiting for the bank manager. And they'd just sit outside my office until eventually they either left or they realized that I wasn't lying.
Hit me, bitch.
Yeah, I'm still that one. Like clients, you know, I was in private banking, clients would, just be a bit too friendly, colleagues being too friendly, like especially once they got drunk, you know, the hands would start and you're just like, oh, God. My uncle gave me a really good tip when I was younger because he was a banker, and he said, always buy the first round. Everyone thinks you're a legend then when you're going out for like work drinks and stuff. Buy the first round. Everyone thinks you're a legend, and then it doesn't matter if you don't participate in the next rounds, and that way you can like manage your alcohol. Let me just say, I hate that we have to do things like that, but like the world, you know, you got to take the world as it is, not how you'd like it to be.
Yes.
Then I had a boss who I had to explain to him once over a lunch, where he had this habit of being like, I want to help you with your career and let's see you achieve these things. And then, come on, come to lunch with me. Let's talk about, you know, this role that I want to create for you. And it was all bullshit. Basically, he would just like, you know, pour the drinks and then start talking about his sex life. And I had to explain to him one day that we would have no relationship other than a professional relationship, and he like needed to accept that. And then at that point, then after that happened, you know, then the gaslighting started and the questioning of your competency and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, all of it I've experienced. What have been things that have helped? One, having good financial well-being so that if I got into a shitty situation, I could just walk away. Two, having both good male and female mentors. I think when I was younger, I had a lot of male mentors because they basically just had all the leadership positions, whereas now, particularly navigating parenthood, female mentors, female guides is super, super important. And then three, talk about it and know your rights is also really important. And if something feels off, it probably is. Like, yeah, I think in the more recent years, I've just become so much stronger in knowing who I am and knowing what's right and what's wrong, and just being comfortable in navigating that and not feeling like personally bad about myself. Just feeling confident in like, no, it isn't personal to me. This is their problem kind of thing. And not sort of taking on a lot of the rubbish behavior that goes on.
Yes, like the amount of stuff that we've just absorbed, you know, because I think there's this thing of like, I don't want to be difficult. I don't want to be seen as being hysterical or angry. I don't want to complain. I'm just happy to be here. I'm happy to be in a high paying male dominated industry. I want to be the cool chick. I think, you know, being comfortable with being able to express when something is not okay is a huge one.
Yeah, it's not easy to do. Like, it took a lot of self-coaching through it. Like, I remember there was a guy I was working with and he was senior to me. I was like a private bank and he was an executive. And every day he would call out across the banking floor something about my outfit or the way that I
looked. I was about to bring up the outfit guy.
Yeah. And I had to ask to see him one day and I was like, look, this is the behavior that you do every day. I don't know whether you intend for it to be like to make me feel something, but this is the perception it creates. It creates a perception that there's some strange dynamic going on between you guys. It creates a perception that I'm just, you know, an aesthetic. It makes me look unprofessional and it's just really bloody inappropriate. And I remember I was like shaking as I said this to him, trying to control, but he was gobsmacked. He was like, I didn't realize that I was doing that. I was like, you're a fucking idiot. But thereafter, it really like made him pull up in his tracks and he like profusely apologized and never did it again. And it was good. It was probably a good learning curve for him. But one of my proudest things about that is that because I was so well prepared and handled it so calmly, he heard it and responded well to it. I didn't get labeled the hysterical woman, which can be really hard to do because sometimes you're mad.
It is very difficult to portray how you're feeling in that kind of situation and keep your emotions at bay because it is so confronting. Mm. And societally, as women, we have been conditioned to avoid confrontation and avoid speaking up. So you're so right. Like, being able to go over there and calmly explain how you feel would have been massive. And I guess, like, a tip would be that if you don't think you can go over to someone and say how you're feeling without getting teary or without getting angry, then there's always an email.
Yeah.
You can write it down.
Yeah. And, like, this is where your mentors come in, is like having good sounding boards. I mean, look, as girlfriends, like, how often have we gotten together to sound out a text to our potential love interest? Like, it's the same, but at work and in a professional setting. But, like, have those people that you can be vulnerable with and be like, this is what's going on. Like, am I crazy? But how should I deal with it? It's so important, because half the time you're dealing with stuff that you've never dealt with before and you don't know how to navigate. But there'll be someone who's done it or done something similar, and those people are worth their weight in gold.
And women are amazing at looking out for each other. Mm-hmm. You know, like, we really want our sisters to succeed, and we want our lessons to mean that, like, the girls who are coming next up in line don't have to go through the shit that we went through.
Absolutely. Yes.
Amen. Finally, before I get into my little rapid fire questions, which I've done this season, which I very much enjoy, you use your professional kind of profile online to share not only your incredible tips and insights into the financial world, but you also really help others by opening up about your personal life. I really like how you're like, here's how I navigated this in my personal financial situation or my personal marriage. And recently you did an amazing post about miscarriage and pregnancy loss, and it was so moving. And I think what I found most impactful was the things that you noted, not only around the physicality of losing a baby, because I think those things need to be fucking verbalized, but also what you found helpful in the aftermath. For those who don't follow you, can you share some thoughts now around that?
Yeah. So, unfortunately, we lost our third baby to, well, it's our fourth pregnancy. It's the third miscarriage that we had experienced. And, miscarriages suck so bad. Like, and you know, people mean well. They say things like, oh, at least you can get pregnant and it's God's way. And, you know, just try again. And
at everyone, least. Why the fuck would you say that to someone?
If you're starting in a sentence with at least, probably stop yourself right there. Particularly to a grieving person of any type, not just miscarriage.
Yes, anyone grieving.
Or cancer, or, you know, someone with an illness. Yeah, just pull up at the at least. At least sentence. But so we lost our third one this time. It was 10 weeks, and yeah, physically it's painful, you know. It varies for people. For me, I've been fortunate in that I've not had to have medical intervention with any of my miscarriages. It's sort of just the body has done what the body will do. But, you know, you are kind of giving birth in its own little way. Your cervix opens, you know, the tissue passes through, you bleed for a while, you have cramps, you have contractions, and it is physically really painful. And particularly at the beginning of it, where there's also that emotional, like, is it a miscarriage? Isn't it? Is it just bleeding? And you're trying to go and get seen, you're waiting for scans and stuff. It's just a lot. I think for my partner and I, because we've been through it a bit before, my husband and I, should I say, we've developed some, like, coping methods. Like, one, we've spent a lot of time understanding miscarriage. And, you know, the first time it happened to me, I was like, is it because I did box jumps at the gym? Is it because I ate that? Is it because I walked too far? No, it's just, it's nature's way. It just happens. It's not your fault, basically. It's not your fault. I've found for us, like, getting support to process it is really helpful. And, like, I know for me, when we start trying again, when I fall pregnant again, I'm going to experience anxiety. So I will be getting support to help me manage that anxiety through counseling and therapy, because I want to, you know, feel better. resources like the Pink Elephant are really great, where they've got services that help you talk to communities and access resources. God, our medical system's pretty bloody amazing. Just like those early pregnancy assessment centers were just so kind and caring. For me, a meditation where I say goodbye to the baby was really helpful for me, and just sort of processing that healing sort of feelings and needing that. Journaling always helps me a lot. And then for my husband and I, we'll always do a ceremony at some point in time when we're ready to say goodbye to that baby. But yeah, for friends and so forth, don't try and fix it. Don't try and minimize it or anything. Just listen and hold people. And, you know, if you can drop a meal around, if you can send them a card or something to let someone know that you're thinking about them, and just kind of check in. And it doesn't have to be peppering check in. Like, it can just be, you know, every couple of weeks or something, just to let someone know that they're not alone, because it's a very isolating, sad and awful experience where you feel like it's your fault until you realize it's not. So yeah, and I just wanted to share it because they say the stats are 1 in 4. I think it would be higher because there's so, you know, one of my miscarriages is not on a medical record because it just happened pretty early in the piece and I hadn't, you know, gone through the medical system at that point. So I do think it's higher, and I just think it's so common, and it's very real grief. It doesn't matter if it happens, you know, at 5 weeks, 10 weeks, 20 weeks, whether it's a stillbirth, it's all grief and it's all awful, because as soon as you see those double pink lines, you start planning.
Your whole life changes.
Yeah.
You know, and I do think this is different when you're the one physically going through the pregnancy. Like I always say, as soon as you see a positive pregnancy test, you're imagining the baby in your arms. Mm-hmm. You're also changing so much of your lifestyle, what you eat, you stop drinking, like, your body changes, like you are so physically in it. There's never a moment that you don't think about the fact mm-hmm. that you are suddenly with child. So, yeah, it's going to be a process when suddenly that's taken away, whether it's you spent 1 week thinking you're pregnant or 10 weeks thinking that you're pregnant.
Yeah.
And I think a real takeaway for me, and what I hope that the listeners heard in you know, your such generous sharing of your thoughts and processes, is that the most important thing to do is actually just acknowledge that you are grieving and allow yourself to grieve. Mm. And I think that if you are related or friends with someone who is going through that, just, again, acknowledging that they're going through something shit and then just shutting the fuck up and letting them, if they want to, talk to you.
Mm.
And that's kind of like, you know, all you can do. It's yeah. really, and obviously, you know, checking in, dropping a meal, things like that are always really helpful as well. But I think the biggest thing is to not brush it under the rug, and societally we do that because we're uncomfortable with it and people don't want to talk about it and people want to make things better. And I also think that, like, as you get older, Chris and I had a discussion about this the other day, and I think we actually might have been talking about you and Brett and your loss. We both acknowledged that when we were younger, when someone would tell us about something unfortunate that they had experienced, you have this almost uncontrollable urge to say something to make them feel better or to fix it. But it's actually, it's, not only does it not help, but it can actually harm. And we both said how we've really learned to just try and be a person, you know, a friend in someone's life who can hold space and just listen and be available. And it really is a learnt skill and it takes self-awareness, you know. And I think it's something that we all, you know, should work on all the time. But I do think that, like, people are getting better at it generationally, because, you know, the generations that came before us, people either just didn't talk about it, or they like to change the subject, or they like to bring up the bright side. Whereas now people actually talk about grief and they talk about loss and and in any capacity, obviously this just doesn't relate to just miscarriage. And I think that there is so much work being done in terms of honouring people's grief and allowing people to actually feel, rather than having this shit swept under the rug and then people self-combusting like 30 years later, yeah, you know, when you bring up their dead father or something. So I think we are slowly moving towards a healthier relationship with being able to, I guess, just express ourselves, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're in an age where resources are just so much more readily available. Like, there's podcasts, there's the internet, there's just so much information at our fingertips. And I think there has just been that shift generationally where we are more open and engaged with things like feelings and healthy feelings and, you know, healthy management of feelings. But I forgot to say, there's a good podcast called Good Morning, like MOURNING, where two ladies have explored their own grief, and then it's become quite this big thing, and now they've got a book. But they did a particular episode on miscarriage with this beautiful woman who's done a really good documentary on it, and I can't think of the name of the documentary now, which is going to annoy me, but that's another really good resource.
I'll add it into the show notes.
Yeah, that's what we'll do. Excellent.
Yeah, I just what's just come to mind for me now is the fact that my mother had two, like, you know, quite awful miscarriages when we were kids, and I just wonder how much support she actually got and how much she was heard. And, you know, the fact that she had to also, like, manage the expectations of her two small children who were expecting another sibling. And my reaction to that and my approach to pregnancy from having mum and dad sitting us down twice, telling us we're going to have a little sister, having baby stuff in the house, like, you know, feeling like that sense of anticipation and then having it not happen and then having that happen again. Like, I remember the second time mum lost the baby, I was at after school care, which I often was because mum was working hard, killing it. But then her best friend came to pick me up from after school care, and I knew the second that I saw her, I was like, I just know my mum's lost that baby. And I was quite young, but, like, I just wonder, you know, and I will have to ask my mum, like, how she was supported in that time. But that then, you know, you talk about, like, the way your childhood impacts the way that you approach life. Like, I certainly had anxiety around pregnancy, I mean, naturally, as you would, and miscarriage, when I went into starting a family myself. And God, I mean, we could talk about this for hours.
Yeah, yeah, but it's very understandable.
But thank you for sharing that. I think that you put it really beautifully, and it's very generous of you to share that experience. And I know that there are so many women out there who found that post so helpful, and so many friends of women who could read that post and go, hey, oh, fuck, I actually, you know, and maybe even more so men, like, oh, my gosh, I didn't realize the physicalities of a miscarriage. I didn't realize that just doing this one simple thing might really help someone. Okay, we're going to wrap this up because we've gone an hour and 10 minutes. I could talk to you all day, baby, but I really want to do these rapid fire questions.
Okay, I'm in the zone.
In the zone. Are you ready?
Yeah,
I think so. We're in the mummy zone, so we'll just continue there.
Yes.
What do you love most about motherhood?
How it makes you be in the moment.
Yes.
It's like just so – I used to just be – I have, like, I don't know if any of the Astros out there, I'm a triple air sign. There's a lot happening cerebrally for me. I get stuck in my head a lot. But a child draws you back into the moment, mostly because you're trying to stop them from killing themselves, but also because of the joy and the wonder and the playfulness. And I've just loved that real grounding that it gives you. Also, like, any ego, any, like – management of exterior stuff, like, all that disappears. Like,
oh my God.
My husband says motherhood's a primal business, and I think he's right.
Brett, fucking hell. It is true, though.
But it is. And but essentially, like, I just think how it just really brings you back to simple pleasures and being in the moment and just experiencing the wonder of life through their eyes. I think that's what I love the most.
I could not agree more. what has been your proudest mummy, your proudest moment rather, in your motherhood journey?
Oh, I feel a bit shy saying it, but I'm going to say it anyway. I feel really proud of my birth, which I think was mostly luck. I think it really
comes
down
to it. You're allowed to be proud of your birth.
But yeah, I had a really
good
birth experience. And I think I was really nervous and I didn't know how it would go, but it went well and I got my water birth that I wanted. And, you know, it was just a really good experience and I was really proud of the way I handled it.
It's a fucking raw, unbelievably physical challenge, and I know that there is a lot of talk about negative birth experiences and we do want to honor them, but what I have found in pregnancy is that no one talks about the positives. So I think you're allowed to feel proud of going through that and giving birth the way that you wanted to do. It doesn't mean that everyone can, because there are some things that are out of our control.
Yeah, totally out of control.
But it also, I just feel like we're constantly apologizing as women particularly for things that we're proud of. Oh, I know that you didn't get the birth that you wanted. I'm really sorry to bring up my birth. No, stand in your power. Share your positive story. Betsy and I both gave birth in the same bath.
I know. With the same midwife.
With the same midwife.
Which was not planned, but he was fabulous.
We both happened
Shout
to
out
have,
to Phil.
Yeah, Phil. Both of our assigned midwives weren't on call when we gave birth, and we gave birth to our firstborn children in the same bath, which I think is pretty fucking cool. Not at the same time.
No, 4 months apart.
Okay, let's take this outside of motherhood. What are you most proud of outside of motherhood? It could be career, personal life, whatever.
I'm really proud of the way I work on myself. Like, I think I'm very humble about there's so much that we just don't know and that we're not born knowing, and it's up to us to learn to be a good human and to learn to live well. And I think that's something I'm always striving for. And I'm just really proud of leaning into that, because I think there's a part of me that very much could have ignored that and just kind of kept doing what I was doing and
held
not
on to your past trauma.
Let it kind of just simmer and fester. But, you know, by leaning into the ugly and the hard and the painful, I've learned that you get to live a beautiful life on the other side. So,
babe, really proud of that. I could not agree more. Hats off to you. You are the biggest advocate for doing the work, and you lead by example. You are always the first to say, oh, I got therapy for this, or like, I really recommend seeing a psychologist for XYZ. Not only are you open about it, which means that other people can feel like, oh, fuck, I'm kind of struggling with that too. Like, you open the door for other people to be able to validate their experiences. But like I said, you do the work. You want to be self-aware. You want to know why you have patterns in certain situations. And I think it's something that I really aspire to. And you've definitely had a positive impact on me with
thanks,
that.
Thanks, gal.
So, yeah, great answer. Tick. Okay, just taking it way more cash now.
Yeah, yeah.
Good. When do you feel sexiest?
Okay. I saw this and I my brain went to a few places. Like, I'm a big fan of like a fucking lingerie set with like all the good stuff. But I also really love when my hair is done and I got my power suit on. Oh, I got to lean into the microphone. Sorry. When my hair's done and I got my power suit on and I'm striding through Martin Place and I'm just
really
feeling
sexy
like a boss.
You do look really sexy. You have some great work outfits.
Oh, Carla Zampatti. I mean, look, what a pioneering, fabulous Australian woman, but her suits, they're my favorite.
Yeah. A lady in the street, but a freak in the street.
Look, boom. I don't know. Cannot confirm or deny.
Does rock a power suit. I mean, I agree. You look so sexy when you're at work. I don't know how Brett lets you get out the door. When do you feel least sexy?
Picking up shit off the floor that someone else has left there. I literally had this fight with Brett. Not even fight. No.
Oh, I thought you meant physical shit. I was toddler life. Oh, no. As in
like I love my husband and he's a beautiful human, but his fatal flaw is that wherever he was when he didn't need to use anything anymore is where he leaves it. And I literally said to him last night, I was like, my love, I have picked up 3 of your things and brought them back to this bedroom today. And what I want to tell you is that it doesn't make me want to fuck you. So please stop doing it.
I mean, that's if that's not a motivator, I don't know what is.
I'm probably being way too honest, but literally, I was like, I want to be your lover and your partner. I do not want to be your mother or your maid. So please, just don't do that.
I ain't your mama. Particularly when you're already mothering children or a child. It's like, dude, I'm at capacity for the mothering.
Yeah, and I think it's like a respect for each other thing. Like, you know, we try and be our best versions of ourselves in relationship so that we can, you know, come together and love each other and have space for that. Whereas, yeah, me spending time picking up your stuff is going to eat into my day and then make me resent you. So please don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No one feels sexy when they're feeling resentful.
No.
You're not going to be dishing out a blow if you're feeling resentful. Mm-mm. No, no, no.
It's not happening.
Okay. What? I don't know why, but I really want to know this about people. What is in your fridge that you buy every week without fail? Like, oh my God, I actually can't get through the day, let alone the week, without this staple or a couple of staples if you can't narrow it down.
Yeah. Like, oh God, there's so many things. Like Marley Spoon saves my life because it gives us healthy meals and I don't have to go shopping. So I don't know if that's a staple.
I said to my friend recently who was getting annoyed at like the mental load of
grocery lists and
of
shopping.
Groceries and like it was always falling on her for dinner. I was like, I have two friends who told me that it basically saved their marriage. Betsy and Beck said, Marley Spoon it up.
Yeah. Well, I like Marley Spoon because they have like a very curated selection of different recipes, and they have like a whole healthy section or kid friendly section, which I like because I want to nourish my body, but I, you know, also am busy and don't have time.
They're super healthy.
Yeah, they're really, really good. So that is like the life staple. I'm trying to decide whether it's butter or milk, but essentially dairy products and ice cream. Like vanilla connoisseur ice cream.
I did not know that. I know you guys love, I didn't realize that you were like every week.
It's just my little treat.
It has to be in there.
But yeah, so, you know, it's all about balance.
I knew about the butter. I knew about the butter.
Butter. You're it's all dairy like products though, isn't it?
Oh, well. Dairy. Okay, speaking of food, do you have a death row meal?
Yeah, cherry tomato crab linguine. Have I made it for you yet?
No, you keep making it and telling me that you're making it.
Oh, sorry, friend.
And once you told me you were making it when we were coming over and then you gave us a fucking plowman's platter and I was like...
She lied to us.
I was a little disappointed.
I'm sorry. I promise I'll make
next
it for you.
Next time I'm coming time. Over, you better be making me that pasta.
That's my current
You've
obsession.
Really mastered it, haven't you?
Yeah, I love it. It feels really like... indulgent and fancy,
but it's clean.
It's clean and it's not that hard. So, you know, I feel like you need to have that recipe that looks really impressive, but it's not that hard.
Oh, I love those. And people come over and you're like, this was not much work, but it looks like it. I'm rolling with it. They can believe what they want to believe.
Yeah.
I kind of also want to know if you have like a cringeworthy moment that your brain keeps replaying in your mind. Like, did you do something when you were younger that you think back on and you're like, fuck.
So I grew up on a sheep and cattle station in northwestern Queensland. I didn't see a lot of people often and I had never travelled anywhere. Like I got to 17. I don't think I'd even been to New South Wales. Like I think...
I actually didn't know that you had done so little travel by the age of 17.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like everything was like within Queensland. Queensland's awesome, just quietly. But, yeah, I think my travels in New South Wales was I stood at the... the McIntyre River at the border of like Gundawindi and walked over the bridge and back. But then at 17, I did a gap year in Poland in a convent with some Franciscan nuns and a bunch of blind kids. And
as you do,
naturally. So I was 17. I caught my first interstate/international flight to Poland. And I was so excited. Like,
oh my God, and you were quite the dork.
I was so
Betsy
naughty.
Was such a like
nerd.
You were like a choir girl. Like you were like the epitome of like a good girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Choir, school captain, sports. I was a good girl.
I can picture so dorky. It now.
But anyway, so I got on the plane and I was just pumped and I chatted to every person on that plane. Like, just if you were sitting near me, I'm sorry. I just was chatty Sally and I wanted to talk to you.
So you thought that the etiquette on planes was like that you really strike up a conversation.
Talk to the people beside you, be really friendly. I don't know.
I mean, the people beside you I can get behind, but the fact that you like made the effort.
So many people and But do you know what? It actually led to a really great outcome. Because I got chatting to this guy who turned out to be a Polish aristocrat and went on a big adventure. That story is for another time, but
that story is for another time.
Yeah, it was good. You know, it had paid its dividend.
So good. Okay.
But so dorky, so dorky.
Such a little dork on your first flight. Okay. Finishing up with an OG Peaches podcast question. So this is the question that we used to start the interviews with to kind of like warm people up and get them feeling chatty. Mm. We've kind of touched on it already, but pet peeves. Tell me more. They're probably going to be related to Brett. Lay it on me.
Well, I was like, I feel like I just gave away a really big
Give
one.
Give me another one. Give me another pet peeve of Brett's that Brett does.
Oh, Brett does. Oh, no, I was going to talk about a driving one.
Oh, no, you can do a driving one.
Okay, so
you don't have to
two things. Him. Not using your indicator when you should, which I know one day Bruce is going to turn around and be like, nice indicator, dickhead, because I will have said it in
dangerous.
The car. It's dangerous. And when you wave at someone and they don't wave back, I think the country girl in me gets really offended.
Oh, I you know, hate like it when people don't wave
the
back.
Little, you're welcome, like, oh, thanks for letting me in, like, oh, and they don't. And I was like,
ugh. I wave so aggressively that Chris gets embarrassed and I'll wave when he's driving. He's like, you don't also need to wave. I'm like, I was just worried they couldn't see you. Like I wave and I wave and I wave and I feel mortally offended if someone doesn't wave.
I know,
back.
It's so rude. It's just a little nice communal moment and they just ruined it.
We're
so,
all humans out here on these roads. Wave back.
Wave back. So, yeah. That's my other peeve.
I identify deeply. Well, babe, thank you so much. I bloody loved doing that with you today.
That was good fun.
Been a while since we've had such a structured conversation, if ever.
I know.
But I really hope that our listeners found that helpful. I certainly did. I love seeing you in your natural element when it comes to finance and work, because you are incredibly impressive and I am your hype girl. I'm your hype girl for all that you are wanting to achieve in this life. And I think that we are very, very lucky to have Betsy Westcott on this planet, pioneering for women and people in general to live their best lives. It's good work that you're doing. It's meaningful work. And I'm really proud of you for quitting that fucking corporate ladder and deciding to find more balance in your life. And I can't wait to see what you do with it. So guys, make sure that you follow Betsy on Instagram, check out her website, check out her online offerings. She has so much to offer to people, PLU, people like us.
People like us.
People in this stage of their lives where they're, you know, they're trying to wrap their head around the big things. And that's it.
Thank you. I mostly just feel embarrassed and blushing, but thank you. It's been such a pleasure. I'm a big fan of the Peachy podcast, and not just because you're my friend, because of the deep conversations and the topics that you explore, putting light on the shadows. I love that.
Well, it was long overdue to have you on, babe. Love you.
Thank you.
Bye.